Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back to my channel for another episode of my history series, where today I want to share with you the story of the Canary Girls. I'm hyper aware that this probably isn't going to be the longest of videos here on my channel, but I've wanted to share this story for ages and I've got a super busy autumn coming up, so I figured this would be the best time to tell this. I just love a story which celebrates women, you know? We know so many stories of the sacrifices of the men, the soldiers, during the two world wars, but what's often glossed over are the sacrifices the women made as well to ensure that the war efforts ran as smoothly as possible from back home and the risk they put their own lives in. Because of course, when the working age men were all called up to fight in 1915 at the beginning of World War I, the workforce was left severely depleted. There were no more men for the traditionally masculine roles such as engineering, transport and heavy machinery factory work, and women had to step up. By the end of the First World War, there were said to be almost 3 million women working in factories across Britain, and a third of these, so almost 1 million, were employed in the manufacture of munitions, military weapons, ammunition and equipment. Of course though, these women were still paid half what the men had been for doing the exact same jobs, and the men who couldn't fight still moaned about women taking their jobs away. But money was power during the wars, and it made sense that factories would want to hire women over men in these times, especially because they created the exact same quality of work and could be paid half of what they paid the men. The women working in these factories were nicknamed munitionettes. The First World War, or the Great War as it was known at the time, marked a huge change in warfare. In wars previous, there had been a reliance on just shrapnel to attack on the battlefield. Whilst artillery was used, it had been a lengthy process to reload guns, and the technology available simply didn't allow for explosive shells. But with the trench warfare of World War I, highly explosive shells were much better suited, as well as heavy guns. The levels of heavy fire seen in the early days of this war weren't anticipated by anyone, and it wasn't long until the UK's entire stock of shells and other ammunition became depleted. There simply wasn't enough of it. In response to this crisis, the government was forced to appoint a Minister of Munitions, someone whose entire job was to oversee and coordinate the production and distribution of munitions in the war effort. And the government also passed the Munitions of War Act 1915, just to make sure that all of this was followed through. This act was purely designed to maximise munitions output, and it made sure that the private company supplying said munitions had to come under the tight control of the Minister of Munitions. The policy said that no private interest was to be permitted to obstruct the service or imperil the safety of the state. Trade union regulations were to be suspended, employers' profits must be limited, skilled men must fight, if not in the trenches, in the factories. Manpower must be economised by the dilution of labour and the employment of women. Private factories must pass under the control of the state and new national factories be set up. And all of this actually happened pretty smoothly, which is shocking knowing what the British government is like. All across the country, like clockwork, national shell factories were set up, taking over existing buildings. Whilst the men unable to fight moaned about the women taking all their jobs, they were actually much safer outside of the factories. Munition factories were prime targets for enemy fire throughout the war, I mean, that makes sense. And factories would routinely be flattened by enemy bombs. Countless numbers of women died just through that alone. But just in general, the working conditions were extremely hazardous inside the factories. Every day, the munitionettes were handling toxic explosive chemicals. The shells filled with a mixture of the explosive TNT and cordite, which acted as the propellant. Day in, day out, the women had to mix the chemicals by hand and then pour the liquid explosives into shells before they were sealed off and sent out to the army. There were the obvious risks to such a job. I mean, sometimes the explosives would go off in the manufacturing process, leaving women dead or seriously injured, with limbs amputated and disfigured for life. In 1916, an explosion at Barmbo killed 35 women. A 1917 explosion at Silvertown killed 73 and injured over 400. A 1918 explosion at the National Shell Filling Factory in Chilwell killed over 130 workers. Amy Dale, who was researching munitions factories for a PhD, told the BBC that every woman in a factory was risking her life every time she handled a shell. You had to take the casing, fill it with powder, put a detonator in the top, and then tap it down. If you tapped too hard, the whole thing would detonate. One pregnant lady had exactly that happen to her. She lost both of her hands and was blinded by the accident. Her baby made it to full term, but once the baby was born, the only way she could identify it was with her lips. But the risk of explosion wasn't the only risk they were dealing with here. There were reports of headaches, nausea, and hives caused by the strong chemicals, and they were at the less dangerous end of the spectrum. There was liver failure, anemia, spleen enlargement, and infertility at the more dangerous end. But the most unusual side effect came in the form of skin discoloration. You would literally turn yellow thanks to the nitric acid in the TNT reacting with melanin in the skin. Hence the nickname all munitionettes carried, Canary Girls. Whilst this looked very odd, this actually wasn't dangerous and the discoloration would eventually fade over time with no long-term health effects that we ever knew of. However, the yellow skin found in pretty much every munitionette also acted as a mask for one of the more serious side effects I mentioned just a moment ago, the liver failure. Liver failure causes jaundice, which turns the skin yellow in itself. Whilst the shades of yellow produced by jaundice and by the exposure were different shades of yellow, if you weren't vigilant, you would have no idea that the TNT had caused something so serious until you were already past the point of no return, until the liver wasn't going to get better. According to one historian, Anne Spurgeon, there were 400 cases of toxic jaundice during World War I, of which 100 were fatal. Health and safety measures were stepped up once this side effect of the TNT was realised, but we're talking fairly minimal measures by today's standards. They provided protective clothing and increased ventilation, but at the risk of losing the war, they couldn't just stop using the TNT. It had to go into the shells one way or another, and that was a risk they were willing to take. It was drilled into the women that this was the risk they had to make. The men were risking their lives overseas, it was only right they had to risk their lives at home. Working in the factories was seen as a patriotic act. They knew that what they were doing was putting them in danger, I mean you could literally see it on your skin, but you were expected to just suck it up and get on with it. Very truly British. They also gave the women milk to combat the effects of the compounds, but as you can imagine, milk didn't really help. There were big fears that static from clothing could cause explosions, and you would on occasion have to strip down to your underwear to be inspected to make sure you weren't bringing anything metal into the factory. The women were banned from wearing anything nylon and silk, and anything metal, as I said, was a no-go, even down to the metal clasp on your bra and hair grips. It had to be strict, and they would have to strip and be inspected. At lunchtimes, the Canary Girls had to be separated from the rest because everything they touched would turn yellow, and even their hair would turn a shade of yellow or green, no matter what colour it was to start with. One woman called Nancy Evans recalled her time working at a munitions factory during World War II, saying, "We were like a canary, we were yellow, it penetrated your skin. Your hair turned blonde and on the top of your crown was the proper colour of your hair." And it wasn't just the women being affected themselves. Their baby started being born with a yellow skin as well, nicknamed the Canary Babies. Shockingly at the time, no one really batted much of an eyelid. Hundreds of babies were born all across the country with this yellow tinge to their skin. It was normal and eventually expected. A woman called Gladys Sangster was one of these canary babies born with this bright yellow skin. She said it gradually faded away and her mother took it for granted. It happened and that was that. Back in 2016, when Gladys was being interviewed about being a canary baby, she was 98 years old, so we can assume there were no long-lasting effects to this. But putting the lives of your unborn babies in potential danger was a high price to pay for such a poorly paid job in the first place. All in all, by June 1917, the munitions factories were producing over 50 million shells a year, and by the end of the war, the British Army had fired around 170 million shells during the conflict. That's a hell of a lot of shells being made across the UK by women. But as I mentioned earlier in the video, when the war began, there was no standard rate of pay for women, meaning that the employers kind of just made up their wages. Of course, they got paid a much lower rate than the men would have done for doing the exact same job. And this was wartime. Food prices rose by a third in the year leading up to July 1915. The women were earning half the amount the men did while still trying to provide for themselves and their families, whilst also putting their lives in danger every time they stepped into the factories. And there was actually a pretty big row over all this. As part of the Munitions of War Act 1915, the Minister of Munitions had pledged not to devalue men's work by lowering rates whilst they were away at war. The men wanted to come home from war and be able to earn the same amount that they did before. The men's unions campaigned for equality, but not between male and female, just wage equality before and after the war. When women campaigned for male and female wage equality, it was argued by both employers and the ministry that it was not considered that one woman was the equivalent of one man, and that women required higher supervision whilst working. They said they would pay women per munition produced, which they said under the assumption that women would accomplish less in the same time as a man would. The War Cabinet did set up a committee in 1917 to look into this equality issue, with a report published in 1919 that found no difference between the sexes in quality of work or production. But regardless, the view that women were less able than men prevailed. In 1918, there had actually been the first strike for equal pay in the UK. Female workers on buses and trams in London went on strike, and it did force the government to look at the gender pay gap in all areas of industry, but little change was actually made on the back of this. It was also later argued that when the women were working throughout the war, they were just trying to earn an individual wage, whilst a man is trying to earn a family wage. Like, these women weren't also attempting to provide for their children whilst their husbands were away at war. At the end of the war, a lot of the munitions factories switched roles. They were now tasked with the job of dismantling shells rather than making them. On the 18th of November 1918 in Pembrey, Wales, three women were killed in an explosion whilst dismantling a different type of shell than what they were used to. So the fatalities didn't just end when the war did. When all of the men returned from war and went back to their roles, out-of-work bonuses were given to women who proved that they had worked before the war. But if you couldn't do that, you were simply expected to return to your home and continue in your role as housewife, and your great service to the country was all but forgotten. The munitionettes never received any recognition for their role, the danger they put themselves in. During wartime, you just roll up your sleeves and get on with it. You do what the government is telling you is the best thing for your country. And there have been many campaigns to bring more recognition to what these women did, but you still don't really hear about them. We hear a lot about the men, the soldiers who risked their lives in the trenches. Why don't we hear about the women? Whilst we know now that the Canary Girls had no long-lasting effects of the yellow on their skin, they didn't know that at the time. For all they knew, it was causing them cancer or serious issues inside that would pop up 10 years later and kill them. But they sucked up and they got on with it because that's what you do during the war, that's what was expected. But they didn't expect to be just forced back into their roles as housewives and be all but forgotten about. Let's change that a bit by talking about their stories. Thank you so much for watching this week's video, and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.